We sit in hipster bars and discuss
if we're poetic enough.
We pet our neuroses till they curl up.
Hello, this is Sarah Willie Hill.
And I am Ashley Marrison. We are
Demons and
Dames. Okay, dun, so dun, first dun, things dun. First. We are recording remotely. That's why.
For the first time.
It's difficult because we can't see each other's faces. So I'm worried we're going to talk over each other quite a lot, Sarah.
I'm so sorry.
Well, we do, to be fair, do that to quite everyone. A lot anyway. So can you tell me a bit about this week's episode, Sarah? Because I was not involved.
I know, and we missed you so much. So this episode is, I did with a good friend, Sophie Dodds, who is also the lead singer and guitar player and writer for Storm the Palace, which is the band who let us use their music for our intro. Please check them out. And we sat down maybe, almost a year ago to kind of explore podcasting and do this, and she agreed to help me out. So this is our very first kind of demo episode. It's a bit rough and it's a bit rough.
and in case it wasn't clear, I'm not in it.
I know.
That's all right. And, that's all right.
I also kind of want to tell people that this, you know, we know that this is kind of a difficult time. We're recording remotely for the first time because, you know, COVID-19 quarantine.
Or as I like to call it, the plague. I was thinking about that earlier, you know, like a couple of hundred years ago, we'd have called this a plague.
Totally.
I want to get an old-fashioned leather mask. You know, one of the ones that look like a bird's beak. I know you can't get any like actually useful masks online anymore, but maybe I could still get one of those.
I think if you dressed up like that and wandered the streets of Edinburgh, like it'd be hilarious. And terrifying.
I wouldn't have to worry about anyone getting too close to me. In a sense, it might serve its purpose.
That's very true. 6 feet of space would be given at all times.
Well, Sarah, you've been a little bit rude about this episode, but it was listening to this episode, the one we're about to listen to now, your juvenilia. Well, it was listening to this that made me realize I wanted to definitely get involved. I mean, I was already pretty sold, but this pushed me over the edge because I think it's fantastic. So stop being so down on it.
Okay.
And for those of you who find it too depressing, why don't you look at some of the cheerier content in our back catalogue? I'm still big on Mary Toft and the Birthing of the Rabbits.
Oh, yeah. Also, I think Queen Tatua is like quite badass and like uplifting.
Yes, you're right. Should we be talking more about the plague, by the way? Do you think people need to hear from it about us? Or do you think maybe they're listening to this to not hear about it for a change?
I don't know. I mean, I'm really looking forward to exploring like the actual plague with you a bit more. I've got some really cool stuff up my sleeve of 1600s London quarantine for the plague. So exciting things in the pipeline.
And I am very eager to talk about Typhoid Mary. Especially since I was virtually accused of being her about 3 weeks ago by somebody they won't be mentioned. It was Sarah. Right.
It wasn't me.
I'm going to get back to polishing my doorknobs with bleach and leave you, Sarah, to get on with the episode.
Okay. Well, I can't wait until you are back with us for the next episode. And good luck finding a plague mask.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. I might have one of them already. All right, everyone. Oh, and yeah, we're going to be putting out content as normal. Nothing can stop us. We are, that's not true. We were late last week, but we are. All right. All right then. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
We sit in hipster bars and discuss
if we're poetic enough.
We pet our neuroses till they curl up.
This week we have a wonderful guest, Sophie Dodds, who is joining me to discuss the life of the notorious Violetta Nozière. Sophie and I both studied history at Oxford together, and she's an incredibly talented, wonderful individual and musician. And would you like to introduce yourself?
Thank you, Sarah. As you know, I'm an old friend of yours. I live in Edinburgh and I play in a band called Storm the Palace, for which I write songs and also sing and play guitar. And I've done various semi-historical, semi-artistic things throughout my life. Will that do?
That's perfect. Thank you. Before we really get into this case, I want to just warn listeners as a trigger warning that this is, Violette is a really fascinating woman and I want to talk about her in life in detail, but there is a lot of sexual abuse and incest in this case. So if that's not something that you're comfortable listening about, please turn off and listen to some of the other ones that we have coming out. Before we get into the life and crimes of Violetta Nozier, can you tell me what you found kind of getting into this case with fresh eyes about what you find so fascinating, or if you do find her fascinating, and why she was kind of demonized by the French public and press?
Well, I think you first described her to me as a cross between a murderer slash victim of sexual abuse slash style icon, which was sounded like a really interesting combination. I feel like she's a really interesting kind of icon of her times, in a sense.
I completely agree with you, and I can't wait to kind of get into more detail about this case with you and see if we can talk about what happened and then maybe lift up the hood a little bit and talk about kind of the deeper kind of why and what hows, and talk about whether this woman was a demon as she was portrayed, or whether she was a daemon when she was a victim, or, you know, both, because people are complicated. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is first, I'm going to talk a little bit about the crime itself and give you an overview of why she's so famous for this as a murderess. And then we're going to talk about her life leading up to this one kind of defining moment, and then kind of go back to the investigation, the trial, the press, and what ended up happening to her. Does that sound good?
Go for it.
So on the night of August 21st, 1933, it's summer, it's late, it's humid, it's hot. Anyone who can afford to is not in Paris because it's bloody miserable in August. Violetta has sitting, you know, she's a fashionably dressed woman. She's sitting in this massive double bed, you know, in her parents' bedroom, sort of rifling through their things looking for money. So this is a two-bedroom apartment. In the next room, which doubled as kind of the dining room and her bedroom, the bodies of her two parents are sprawling on this folding cot. She finds, I think it's 3,000 francs, which is this very significant amount at the time. She finds it, she crams it into her purse, she looks one last time at her parents, and then making sure that no neighbors are awake, she exits, closes the door, creeps down the stairs, and does what I think any sensible young woman does right after committing a double homicide, or potentially committing a double homicide. She calls up a girlfriend, goes out on the town, checks into a hotel, and has about 2 days where she goes on this massive shopping spree, and then has a two, like, proper nights out with her friends. I was being sarcastic, of course. The next day, she's actually sent a cable back to her parents, telling them that she's out partying with a friend and she won't be back until late. And she comes back on Monday. She creeps up into her parents' apartment. She turns on the gas, and then she pretends to loudly come home, find the gas on, and goes and wakes up a neighbor at like 3 a.m. on the Monday and says, you know, my parents have tried to commit suicide, please call the police. Mm-hmm. Her father at this point is dead, and her mother has slipped into a medical coma. At first, the police think that it was either suicide on the part of both of her parents, or that her father had died of a brain hemorrhage, because I think that's his actual cause of death, mm-hmm. and that the mother, so bereft that her husband has died, poisons herself and turns on the gas. And Violetta is not suspected. That is until her mother wakes up in the hospital, and the policeman, who is Marcel Guillaume, So Inspector Marcel Guillaume takes her to the hospital to see her mother, who's miraculously come around, and he, when he's not looking, Violetta disappears. And that's the first inkling that he or anybody else has that maybe she had a hand in this and it wasn't an accident. I believe at that point they put out an arrest warrant for her. In the meantime, she's been staying in a hotel under the name of her friend that she was out partying with while her parents were laying poisoned in the flat, which isn't... She's not exactly what I would call a smooth operator. And she's, you know, she's going around, she's going on loads of dates. I think she picks up maybe 3 or 4 men at different points during the 7 days. She goes on another shopping spree with all this money that she's gotten. One of the men who she'd gone on a date with recognized her from her press photos, and instead of arriving at the cafe to meet her for the date, sends in the police, which...
Charming.
Yeah, it's kind of a dick move as well. Reading about him, I don't remember his name, and I'm going to apologize for that. He was evidently of a higher social status than her, and so he thought it was quite a fun thing to do, is just kind of string her along so he could set her up with the police.
Right. So he recognized her straight away.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But still, quite a dick move, I think. But she is then taken in, and the inspector, Marcel, asks her, you know, did you kill your parents? And she immediately confesses. Mm-hmm. So there's no effort at subterfuge or anything. She confesses, and at this point, he actually has her alone, which becomes a bit problematic later because there should have been somebody else in there in the interrogation with her. And he asks her, why did you do this? And she just has a complete meltdown at that point. And this is according to his accounts of what happened, and tells him that her father had been raping her for the past 6 years. Constantly, she'd been suffering abuse at his hands since the age of 12. And this comes out, he believes her, and he's the investigator, but this doesn't fit with the narrative of the day. And as I think we're going to talk about, incest at this point was so taboo. I was looking into this, and incest in itself was so taboo, it wasn't even illegal. So in theory, it might have been covered by other laws around abuse and rape. But in itself, it explicitly wasn't illegal in France. It had been illegal under the laws of the Catholic Church. And then under the French Revolution, and under the Napoleonic Code, they'd gotten rid of that because they said that these rules were not secular rules. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they should be gotten rid of. And I actually thought when I was first doing research into this case that this case was, you know, important partially because it changed that. And much to my shock, I found out that incest was only explicitly made illegal in France in 2010. So again, the type of incest that we're dealing with in this case, where you have an adult father raping an underage daughter, would have been covered in the code because it's basically forcible penetration of a minor. But explicitly, it wasn't until 2010 that it was made into law, and at the time, one of the French prime ministers said that, you know, this is a victory for the 2 million French people that are alive today that have survived incest.
Yeah. I think we were talking about this before, and you made an interesting comment that... So obviously the term incest brings up different things for different people and doesn't, in terms of pure definition, mean non-consensual. But you were saying how... that there's this element of the power dynamic, and that this kind of the French cliche in a way of the consensual incestuous relationship is actually very rare.
Yeah, I mean, I think any time, and this is just going to be me coming down on a moral line where I think all incest is wrong, because, and I don't think it's just about the genetic thing. If you have people, if it's two sisters and there's the same sex and there's no chance of getting pregnant, I don't think that's why it's wrong. I just think that within a family group, the power dynamic is such, I don't think real consent is fully possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly between parents and children.
Certainly.
Yeah.
But I think even in the other cases, and the reason I use the example of two sisters is in Ireland, the incest law only covers the illegality of incest between siblings of the opposite sex, which I thought was quite interesting. It turns out the law was created in 1908, and it was probably just oversight that that sort of thing actually happens.
Yeah. Back to the case.
Back to the case. I think it's really difficult for us in, like, the modern day time to fully comprehend how big this case was in French society. Mm-hmm. When I was reading about it and looking at these old newspapers, this is also when print is the main form of media, and the press loved this case because you had this fashionable, you know... She's termed as being very beautiful. I don't think she conforms to kind of modern day standards of beautiful, but at the time, you know, she was, when she was arrested, she was wearing this black beret and this black coat with this giant fur collar.
Fur collar, yeah.
It's a fabulous coat. I would kill for that coat. No pun intended.
Yeah.
And
she had that classic little kind of 1930s pouch, didn't she?
She did. And she was, the way that she was portrayed was as this incredible femme fatale, this female villain, the poisoner, who had killed her parents because she wanted money and because she was going to inherit 18,000 francs, which isn't even that large of a sum of money. And the papers just ran wild with it. What's also interesting is that even though the papers loved her and they loved to portray her in this incredibly villainous way, as soon as it was leaked, and it took a very long time for the accusations of incest to come out, the papers wouldn't refer to it directly. They described it as an abominable lie, an odious accusation, but they never actually talked about the incest directly. And instead, they described her as a rotten youth who symbolized for the country this immoral youth who had lost their way, mm-hmm. and someone that had been put above her place. So I think what's also important about this case is she was from a very middle-class bourgeois working family done good. The background of her parents, Jean-Baptiste Nozier is her father. He's from a rural town outside of Paris. He was keen in school. He ended up getting a sponsored scholarship, so he went slightly further than the elementary education that would have been standard. And he gets a job with a big rail industry as an engineer, moves to Paris, meets her mother, Germaine, who is also from a really provincial town 100 miles south of Paris. They ended up getting married, and they were seen as these, like, the utmost respected bourgeois class, but because they'd given Violette a lot of attention, they'd sent her to really good schools. It was very, very, very unusual, almost unique for a girl of her age at 18 to not be in part of the workforce in her class. And it was seen that they had, by sending her to these schools and by spoiling her, they had given her all of these pretensions, and almost, it was almost like because of that, they had deserved what they'd gotten, and this is what happened.
Right.
And that was the narrative that was portrayed in the papers.
So clearly this case tapped into something that was already latent in French society at the time. There was some kind of zeitgeist.
Oh, I think very much. Also, another thing is, France during this period, if you're looking at the demographics, it's an older society. And the youth that are coming is seen are seen in general as being kind of morally bankrupt, and so this is the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
It's the time before the war. You have these parents who have gone through World War One, and that's such a formidable thing. And you have this entire generation of carefree youth,
mm-hmm.
who are better off, better educated, have more opportunities. And I think there was a massive resentment about that. And Violetta, by being the patricide and by poisoning her father, was this weird kind of pinup that the older people could cluck their tongues at and say, you know, she not only did she, was she better educated than she should have been, and she was, they focus a lot on her sex life and what was seen as like her sexual misconduct by having boyfriends, by being sexually active in a time where chastity among women and of her age and social standing was still very much prized. And it's just, she was like the pinup girl for everything that was wrong with that. In addition, this is kind of the first time that working class girls can look wealthy, because the kind of the manufacturing of clothing and the fashion changes as such that that's accessible, and you can no longer know which class someone was from based on their clothing.
And obviously you had this huge destabilization of society following the First World War, and it's a really radical time for gender, and you know, you have the huge kind of leap forward in women's fashion in the 1920s, and what's his name, Paul Poiret, who did away with the corset and invented the hobble skirt and whatnot. And yeah, I mean, for an older generation, I guess it was probably a very confusing time.
That explains why there was kind of so much hatred and like kind of visceral hatred that was portrayed against this young girl, and that absolutely 100% did not fall in line with her as a victim of sexual abuse. Not to mention that incest particularly was seen that was something that maybe happened in the countryside of, you know, there was this idea that I read a lot about where the widowers would, who were without a wife, would maybe sleep with their daughters in the countryside, but that these were peasants and they were, it was an animalistic act and they were no better than beasts.
Mm-hmm. And then for a respectable Parisian lower middle class family.
Yeah. And then it was so taboo that the fact that she'd brought this to the light horrified people, I think, more than her murdering her father.
Mm-hmm.
I can kind of understand like that kind of gut reaction. I think even in modern society, to some extent, like these things happen a lot more often we like to think about.
And when you read about her, if you do an internet search on her, there's still a lot of focus on the crime above what she was put through. And there is still a sort of sense of blame. I mean, it's obviously, this is a controversial issue because we're not sitting here necessarily saying that that her actions were completely justified, but
I don't know. I might go out and
maybe
win there.
Maybe you would be saying that. I don't know. But yeah, I guess the point is that, you know, there's a context, and we shouldn't. Yeah, we really shouldn't be surprised if someone who's been through that kind of experience ends up making questionable decisions.
Yeah. So I'm gonna kind of rein back in from looking at the crime, and maybe let's talk about kind of her life up until that point a little bit, and explore a bit about who she was. I think the place is quite important, and I'm probably going to mispronounce this word, so Sophie, please jump in. She was from the 12th arrondissement.
Arrondissement.
And their apartment was on the 6th floor of the Rue de Madagascar. This is a neighborhood where one of the main employers is the railway. So there's a huge railway station there. It's seen as a very respectable working class neighborhood. There aren't any bars, there aren't any prostitutes. It's generally families, shops, a lot of skilled workers.
I think we should just clarify, because I think we've used both middle class and working class to describe her family.
And it's interesting because both are used throughout all of the texts that I'm looking at.
Okay.
And so I'm going to actually say that they've been described as both aspirational working class, or working class made good, and as being very bourgeois.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm not really sure where the line was.
There probably is no line.
Yeah. Well, I think that's part of one of the interesting things about this case is that you're coming into a period where these class lines are blurred more, and Violetta is the embodiment of that.
Yeah, and very much demonized for her apparent class aspiration.
And those of her parents. Like, her parents are blamed for their own murder because they gave her ideas above her station.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, in kind of the modern world we live in, that seems insane. But I understand, like, in the 1930s, the challenges people had to kind of the social norms, it almost reminds me of Brexit. I shouldn't have mentioned Brexit. in general, she had quite a normal girlhood, as far as it can be determined. She went through elementary education. She was described as her teacher as good, amenable, and by one teacher, very average. But then when she's 12, she has to repeat her first year in the Sophie Germain School, which is a private further primary school. It's the first of those she goes for quote-unquote health reasons. Some doctors relooking her case during the trial speculate that this illness was in fact psychosomatic. But this is when the abuse began. And so her symptoms of suddenly her behavior changes, she's ill all the time, she's frequent stomach aches, like this is very much in line now with what we know, you know, when children are being sexually abused, these are the kind of things that they start exhibiting. Mm-hmm. When she leaves Sophie Germain several years later, her teachers do not describe her quite as well. They call her lazy, devious, hypocritical, vain, avoids works, questionable behavior. According to her classmates, she started seeing boys, some perhaps quite seriously, and these included a childhood friend from the neighborhood and also possibly later, possibly at the same time, a mechanic who is 6 years older than herself. And he, during the trial, he claims that they never actually had sexual relations, but most people don't believe him. By the spring of 1932, so this is a year before the neighborhood, before the murders.
Okay.
In the neighborhood, Violetta has quite a reputation for being scandalous because of her behavior around men,
mm-hmm.
generally speaking. And again, this is, at this time, especially within her class, chastity is seen as like the primary virtue.
Mm-hmm.
Reports from her secondary school says she's diligent when in class, but often absent for health reasons, and, I quote, must be watched outside class, end quote.
Mm.
After this, even though she's seen as being quite a mediocre student, she's enrolled in 1931 through connections of a family friend to the most prestigious girls' school in Paris. And this is in the famous Latin Quarter in Paris. She only lasts a couple of weeks, actually. Like, she basically flunks out. She's completely out of her depth, both socially and academically, and she doesn't feel like she belongs, and she can't go through with it. But for her, this opens up a new period in her life where she starts spending all of her time in the Latin Quarter. She starts making friends. She meets Jean Leblanc, who's probably her first serious, serious boyfriend. And she hangs out with him and his group of friends. Reading about it and reading about her accounts of this time in her life, it feels like she suddenly becomes her own person at this time.
Yeah.
She starts getting into trouble. There's an incident where she steals a book and gets into quite a lot of trouble with her parents around this. And she's acting out. She's known for telling incredibly tall tales. It's quite interesting because a lot of the tall tales involve sort of self-aggrandizement, but also a psychological separation from her parents. So she'll tell people that her father is somebody else, or she's got a uncle who's a famous policeman, or she's going to inherit a lot of money from this wealthy aunt. And it's quite interesting. In one of the books I was reading, which I would highly recommend to anybody who's interested in this, it's called Violette Nozier, A Story of a Murder in the 1930s Paris. It's by Sarah Mazza. And it's just a brilliant academic account of this whole case. But she goes through this and looks at kind of the Freudian analysis of the lies that she's telling to all of these people in the Latin Quarter, and how, again, this is really in line with what we understand that victims of sexual abuse, especially sexual abuse that's being perpetrated by someone who's supposed to be a protective father figure, does to the psychology. And it's her way of kind of distancing herself from this. She's described by one of these friends, and I like this so much I wrote it down, as a good egg who always stood him a beer. And what's quite interesting about this is that the accounts of this period of her life differ widely. She obviously has quite a lot of money to spend, and still to this day, nobody's quite sure where it was coming from. So there are some reports that she was working as a prostitute, but there are only kind of two cases that they can find of this, and each time these men kind of came forward as soon as she was arrested, they didn't give her very much money. I think it was maybe 100 francs, and she'd asked for loads more. They said no, and then she slept with them anyway. And the only, so she was, if she was working as a prostitute during this period of time, she was definitely not
a shrewd businesswoman.
Not a shrewd businesswoman. But she did seem to really enjoy sleeping with Middle Eastern men. So that seemed to be what she was getting on that from her end. And again, this is something that came out in the press and I think was used very much against her. And the press focused almost entirely on what was perceived to be her own sexual deviance, opposed to that of, say, her father.
I mean, even in the notes that I read that you've taken, there's very little analysis of what he was motivated by.
Her father?
Yeah.
I don't know. There's something that I found myself thinking throughout this entire thing that was really dark, was asking, like, reading the account of her father's own childhood, which I've read a lot around, it's really normal. It's kind of like poor boy turned good. Mm-hmm. He was maybe a bit awkward. His colleagues described him as being very quiet and very serious. He never visited prostitutes, which is something that they would do a lot when they were out. He spent a lot of time at home. He wasn't very sociable. But there's nothing behind his life that really explain to me why he could be such a monster. And that, I mean, what I found really difficult with that and what I struggled is that if he wasn't such a monster, and in order to rape your own daughter systematically for years, maybe you don't have to be a monster to do that.
Well, he's at least aware that he was monster.
Or maybe there isn't something external that has made you into a monster to do that. Maybe it was just something within him, and that really scares me. I don't think that most of the people at the time believed her enough to want to really go into that or explore that.
Yeah.
And I think since then, especially as there was a film that was made in the 1970s that really explored this, and it was the first time in kind of public culture that she was exonerated to some extent and believed, it was kind of too late by that point to really go back and understand. And one of the things that comes up through this film that was made in the 1970s is they claim that Jean-Baptiste was not actually her real father, and that her real father had been someone named Emile. I personally, in all the research I did, could not find any substantial evidence to this.
This is one of the theories as to where her money came from, though, isn't it?
It is. It is possible that she did have a wealthy benefactor, and there are a couple of people that have had fingers pointed to them of who this could possibly have been, including one person that committed suicide right around the trial. And it is possible this person existed. Whether this person was her natural born father, I feel like it's all pure speculation. And I feel like the speculation is very much born out of a place where people are so shocked by the fact that a father could be raping his daughter that they want to excuse it by saying that he wasn't her real father.
Yeah.
So,
or at least mitigate it somehow.
I wanted to kind of read you your own account, her own account in her own words about the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't feel like there's anything I can say more than what she has said. So again, this is a bit heavy. It was when I was 12, when my mother was off at the market, that he started touching me with his finger. At this point, I was very ignorant of those things. He took me the first time one morning when I went to his bed to say good morning. The beds were placed then as they are now. I was surprised and did not resist. At the start, and for about a year, I gave in. But when I became a woman, I realized the horror of my situation. The reason I said nothing to my mother is that my father had convinced me I was as guilty as he was. At that time, I was in school of the Rue de Wagins. There was not a teacher who took any special interest in me, and I had no intimate friends. I had no close relatives in Paris. The encounters continued at home when my mother went out shopping, for instance, to get food for my father's basket on the shed in the garden we used to have. We had relations sometimes on a chair and sometimes on the ground. The shed was about 1 meter 50 by 50. It was torn down less than 3 years ago. My mother did not know what was going on, but she could have noticed. She saw Papa kiss me on the mouth several times, and he was constantly stroking me. Sometimes when she came up from fetching the milk, she found me laying beside Papa, but she did not say anything. I was in my nightgown.
So that kind of leads us on to the mother and what was going on with her. Because she's an interesting one.
Tell me your thoughts.
I suppose, essentially, I feel deeply sorry for the mother. I think she was in chronic denial about what was happening. You haven't talked in much detail about the trial yet, so I don't want to preempt you, but I know that, you know, she behaved pretty badly during that time, but then kind of flipped. It was obviously some part of her that did love her daughter underneath everything. You know, Violette was, what happened to her was horrifying, but she rebelled against that, didn't she? And she, you know, she had her voice heard, whether or not she was believed. But her mother is this completely and utterly repressed character, caught between a rock and a hard place, and
I think this might be a good opportunity to talk a little bit about what did happen and the role her mother had it.
Yeah.
So the mother comes round from being in this coma and immediately blames her daughter. She describes how Violetta fed them medicine and had given them a doctor's note from a doctor she'd been seeing that told them to take these headache powders, and how she mixed up the three of them. She mixed up these three packets of powders and three glasses, gave them to them. And then Violetta actually jokes at this point, "Don't worry, Mama, I'm not trying to poison you."
Mm.
Which is, I mean, it's pretty dark stuff.
Yeah. Mm.
Violetta, you know, after she's arrested, she confesses to this and describes in great detail how she made up three different packets, one for her father, which was full of poison. It was Veronal. And then she had magnesium salts. And in her father's packet, it was completely just Veronal. In her mother's packet, it was a mixture of Veronal and magnesium salts. And in her packet, it was just magnesium salts, which makes most people, including the police at the time, think that she did not mean to kill her mother. She just meant to make her mother very ill.
So that she wouldn't intervene.
So that she wouldn't intervene.
But it's also this kind of perfect metaphor for her potentially mixed feelings towards her mother, isn't it?
I completely agree. I think what we also haven't mentioned yet is that this is actually the second attempt. The successful attempt was in August. The first attempt was actually in March. And at that point in time, she had given all three of them sleeping draughts and then set the curtains on fire. But they had been, and it was very much, this was very much a murder-suicide attempt, mm-hmm. unlike the successful one. And a neighbor smells the smoke, breaks in, and it's very much brushed under the rug as an accident.
Yeah.
Which, again, I think goes to the level of denial that must have been going on with the mother.
I find it quite interesting that the mother instantly accuses Violette the moment she wakes up, mm-hmm. which makes me suspect that perhaps that there'd been something brewing for a while, because if there hadn't, she might not necessarily have jumped to that conclusion.
In December of the previous year as well, she had left a note telling her parents she was going to go drown herself in the Seine, and they find her before she does and prevent her. So I think the fact that she doesn't just go in and commit murder, there we see things leading up to this,
mm-hmm.
and her behavior is very much kind of spiraling out of control. It strikes me as being a palpable cry for help, really, that then escalated, and that wasn't heard. A lot of people at the time as well say they don't believe her stories about the abuse because she never told anybody.
But it turns out she did.
It turns out she did. So we find out during the trial that 18 months prior, and this is well before the first time she tries to commit suicide or the second time she tries to commit suicide and kill her parents and the murder, she tells Pierre Camus, who's a good friend of hers. And remember, this is the time she's hanging out in the Latin Quarter and she's got independence. And I think for the first time, she also has real friends mm-hmm. who have no connection to her old life. In the account that he gave of this, she didn't explicitly say what it was. She said that things were very bad at home and that her father was not treating her the way a father should. But it was enough that he understood what she meant. And she was known for telling these outlandish stories all the time. But he took her very seriously because she told him incredibly reluctantly. And her attitude and manner was completely different than mm-hmm. when she was kind of telling these tall tales about her non-existent wealthy policeman uncle.
Yeah.
She also told her first serious boyfriend, Jean Leblanc. We're going to pretend that's how you say it. And his reaction, true gentleman, immediately broke up with her.
So may well have believed her, but just didn't, was horrified, disgusted.
Didn't want to deal with this
by
shit.
By the idea. Didn't yeah. want to be with a woman who was being raped by her father.
Yeah. Which I get. I understand that kind of visceral things, but I don't approve of his behavior one little bit.
No.
And I think his reaction to that probably is one of the things that put her in this kind of downward spiral of where it's like her first serious boyfriend and she's suddenly horribly rejected.
Yeah, and she attempts to be honest and to try and flag up what's going on and it blows up in her face, which kind of provides a context for her subsequent action.
The other thing that's important to talk about, I think, that between March and August, in March she attempts to kill herself and both of her parents and was unsuccessful. In August, the attack is much more premeditated, it's much more thought out,
yeah.
It is successful, and it is very much directed at her father.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason for this is that between March and August, she falls in love. And she describes this as the only, even though she slept with, at the time it was considered loads of men, I think by modern standards it wouldn't have been.
Yeah.
This is the only person she's ever loved. And this is Jean Dabin. He comes from actually quite a similar background to her. His father also works for the railway, but he is a legal student. And like her, his parents definitely have quote-unquote ideas above their class. They want him to be wildly successful. They're very much pushing him to make a good marriage to a girl who's wealthy and of a higher social status than him. And so it's kind of ironic, or perhaps makes sense, that these two people coming from that background find each other. She was incredibly serious about him. She paid for everything. Again, nobody knows really where she was getting all this money, unless this wealthy benefactor did in fact exist. She's very serious about it. He's not really.
Mm-hmm.
Pictures of him, he's quite bookish looking.
Mm-hmm.
He's got like this, he's quite attractive, but he's got this massive part and these really big black rimmed glasses. And he reminds me kind of caricatures of like Ichabod Crane. Who's like just this kind of like, if you imagine a cartoon lawyer in your head from the 1930s,
right.
I feel like you make that about 10 years younger and this is Jean
okay.
Dabin. But she just falls massively head over heels in love with him. On the night of the murder, and I think this is very important, her parents find letters between the two of them. And her mother's initial reaction is complete shock and outrage. And then they find out that he's also the son of an engineer for the same railway. And they immediately want them to get engaged. And her mother is enthusiastic.
This is all happening the same
night. This is all happening in the same night. Like, within a matter of hours, like, her mother's... And this is the account both from the mother and from Violetta herself, mm-hmm. is that they realize that he's a very good, acceptable match, that the daughter's really, really serious, and they immediately want to ask the parents of Jean to allow for an engagement. And they even say they would be able to provide a dowry for her, which is something that they had told her that they wouldn't be able to do.
But then doesn't her father say something about her having syphilis?
Yeah. So this is something that is recorded both in Germaine, her mother, and Violetta's account of the evening, mm-hmm. is the father turns around after those kind of huge rejoicing over several hours about this wonderful match for their daughter and says, oh, by the way, we're going to have to tell them that you have syphilis. And the message that Violetta got from this is that once they know your damaged goods, they'll never take you and you'll never be able to leave or escape me.
Yeah. So how did her father know that she had syphilis?
So this is an interesting kind of point in the story. She may or may not have had syphilis.
Yeah.
It's quite possible it was a false positive. She was seeing doctors left, right, and center from the time that she's 12 to 18. Again, physical manifestations of sexual abuse are very common.
Yeah.
And there was a doctor, Dr. Durand, who was treating her for syphilis. And he actually told her parents that syphilis was an inherited disease and treated all three of them for it, even though her parents both came up as negative for the disease.
Didn't she convince her doctor to tell them this?
Or? Yeah, so she convinced the doctor to tell them this, and he was very sympathetic. And then it was his letter that she forged about with the headache powders to convince them to take them when she actually did poison them. And some people have looked on it saying the fact that she had syphilis, but her father didn't have syphilis is evidence that the incest wasn't taking place. There are a lot of other people that say she was tested for syphilis later and didn't actually have it. I think it's quite difficult to weigh in on that one.
Yeah.
Especially without kind of the modern medicine and testing methods that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But it does add kind of an interesting nuance to everything. And the fact that there was this sympathetic doctor really allowed her to then commit the murder,
mm-hmm.
by allowing her to forge a letter from him. And we do have a copy of the letter, and it was not very well forged, shall we say. It was good enough to fool her parents, but... I kind of wonder about that. I wonder if they just wanted to believe. And the fact that she tells her mother, don't worry, Mama, I'm not going to poison you, I think shows how warped the family dynamic is between all of them.
Yeah.
After she's arrested, the police stage a confrontation between her mother and Violetta. And accounts vary, but it was conclusively heart-wrenching. Germaine keeps screaming at her daughter over and over again, you killed your father, you're spreading lies, kill yourself. It is difficult for me even just reading about knowing that this happened.
Yeah.
You know, 90 years ago, it's so heart-wrenching. The judge is quite an important character, Edmond Lannoy.
Sounds all right.
Okay. He began to look into the charges of incest. One thing that's interesting as a historian looking into this case is that there were thousands and thousands of letters that are written to the judge before the trial as he's doing this investigation. And a lot of these are letters of outrage, are letters that show the public reaction that she was, Violetta was rising above her station, and she'd been encouraged by her parents to rise above her station, and they therefore deserved it. But then there's a whole host of letters that are written by women mostly, but also men that had been abused as children, just begging this judge, Edmond, to believe Violetta.
Mm-hmm.
And I read quite a few of those letters, and it's just, I found it heart-wrenching. And I think that those letters are really important, because there were people standing up and saying, I believe her, it happened to me.
Yeah.
And I think having recently lived through the kind of beginnings of the Me Too movement and seeing this kind of the same behavior, it's really powerful. And I think it's one of the kind of lasting powerful impacts that this kind of case has on French society. That's really important. Violetta also gives more evidence that then kind of supports her claim. She describes her father's unclad body with incredibly good detail, where his moles were, etc. She then said that in order to avoid making her pregnant, he would withdraw and ejaculate into a bunch of rags that he had in the corner in the back of his room. And the police go in and they find this red rag with her father's semen all over it, where she said it was going to be. They also found a collection of dirty songs he'd authored and a stash of quite disturbing pornography. And when this is uncovered, the press, some of the press, began to put forward doubts that she was lying.
Mm-hmm.
And begin to address the fact. Her mother, at the same time, gives an interview to try and discredit her in the press, which, again, is just, I think, is really difficult to kind of take in.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother goes a lot further than that. She actually shows up in front of the judge, Edmond, and puts forward a prosecution against her daughter. And what this does, and I do not understand the French legal system at the time, or now, to be honest, enough to explain why, but it means that this is now a case where Violetta is, the potential is for this to be a capital punishment crime, and that was not the case before her own mother puts charges against her. It also means that Violetta's mother is not allowed to testify at the trial, and it means that Violetta herself is legally orphaned, which is quite, I think, is quite harrowing.
Yeah. She was 18, 19 when this was happening?
She was 18.
At the time, you were still a minor until you were 21, is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Edmond, the judge, was incredibly shocked, as were Violetta's lawyers, the public, and probably Violetta herself, that her mother would do such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this judge, Edmond Lannoy, I hope I'm saying his name right, he doesn't come across very well from the trial, to be quite honest. But the fact that when this happens, he himself is so taken aback and shocked, I think shows you just how significant this was.
Yeah, do we feel like this was almost the start of the turning point when things started to kind of go back in her favor, or sympathy started to grow?
Maybe
that there was almost this feeling that, you know, that if your mother's turned against you this violently, that
yeah,
maybe you were neglected somehow.
I don't know if the public tide of turned in Violetta's favor at this point. I think it happened much, much, much later.
Right.
And I don't think it may have happened until the 70s, from what I've read, but
I mean, in terms of her, sorry to jump the gun a bit, but yeah, in terms of her sentence, you know, because it was eventually commuted from death to life imprisonment.
I don't know. I think it's a good question.
So something shifted during that period.
Something shifted. At the start of the trial, Edmond, the juror, opens the trial telling the jury that she's a notorious liar and not to believe anything that she says. I think he might have been sympathetic to her that her mother was doing this to her, but I think he himself did not believe her.
Yeah.
And
but maybe that wasn't so important as to whether or not he believed her as to how innocent and vulnerable he felt she was, you know,
at
the point at which she felt that she was at her most vulnerable, then even if he thought that she was still lying, he started to sympathize a little bit.
I don't get a good enough sense of him.
Yeah.
Because I have gone through all the letters that were written to him, and some of the translated trial transcripts. But he honestly, he just comes across as like a really patriarchal dick, if I can say that.
That's all the more reason, I think, in a way, that it would take something like that for him to sort of then feel like, well, you know, I'll switch from my role as as persecutor to my role as the kind of benign, clement sort of forgiver. It's like that situation when you're having an argument with someone and then you finally give in and then they suddenly step down and stop trying to convince you.
Yeah. The trial starts in October of 1934. She's being brought forward now for premeditated murder. And this was punishable by guillotine, unless extenuating circumstances could be found. The jurors were always male at this time. And I looked this up. Women did not get the right to vote in France until 1945.
Mm-hmm.
What strikes me about this trial is that Violette is not being tried by her peers. She is being tried very much by the peers of her father.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, the judge opens with a warning to the jury not to believe a word she says, and it really goes all down from there. He mentions her quote-unquote inane defense. They bring her mother up and the fact that her mother has, you know, brought charges against her and has in the press said that she was lying. They bring all of the men she slept with that they can find, which unfortunately in a lot of cases still today, where sexual assault is in question, happens, and it just fills me with indomitable rage. But I think particularly at the time, that was seen as the most sensible thing to do.
Yeah.
And so they use that as a way of discrediting her. Her own lawyers, and there are three of them, didn't bring up the incest directly in court. They kind of allude to it.
Yeah.
But it feels like they think no one's going to believe her, so why bother trying? And the lawyers that she had were quite famous, but everyone looking at this says that they really didn't do their job.
It reminds me a bit of I don't know if you watched, I can't even remember the name of it now, it was a BBC TV series, but I think it was based on an Agatha Christie book, and it was about this murder and the wife. This is a massive spoiler if anyone's planning to watch it. I can't remember what it's called now.
Can you even spoil Agatha Christie?
Absolutely, because it has a really unexpected ending. This murder happens, and a guy is the obvious, there's this man who's the obvious perpetrator, and his wife or his partner testifies against him in court, and eventually the jury decide that he's innocent. But then it turns out in the end that he wasn't innocent at all. And actually the whole thing was planned between the two of them because they knew that if she came forward as this kind of neurotic woman blaming him, that the jury would automatically sympathise with
them. I can think of three Agatha Christies where she's done that.
Really?
Yeah. I say this, I jokingly say, Ken, you're an Agatha Christie. It's because I have literally actually read all of them. I went through a really obsessive period of my life in Beijing where I listened to every single audiobook of everything she's written under her name and her pen names.
Right.
And one of the things I actually love about Agatha Christie is she recycles plots. And so you get into one,
yeah,
and you think, oh, I've read this before, and it ends completely differently.
Right, I see. She's sort of exploring different possibilities.
I know, and that's something I absolutely adore.
Obviously, about her. Yeah, because she was writing a lot during the 30s, wasn't she? That's why you're so drawn to this case, because there is something very Agatha Christie about it.
Getting back to the life and times of Violette Nozière, the jury deliberates for less than an hour. And that I find that so shocking. And they come back with the verdict of guilty of parricide with premeditation and no attenuating circumstances, which carries an automatic sentence of death. When they read this out, Violette is completely like stone cold faced. She makes no response. And it's only as she's leaving the court and her lawyer comes up to her to try and get her to sign an appeal that she breaks down and shouts, "No, no, leave me alone. You're a bunch of bastards. You have no shame. You're without pity. I told the truth. To hell with my father. To hell with my mother."
Powerful stuff.
It is powerful stuff. And as I said, I think Violette was denied extenuating circumstances by a jury not of her peers, but of her father's peers and judges and prosecutors that did their very best to declare the matter over and done with.
But then at some point in the next few days or a couple of weeks, is it?
So her mother and her lawyer start petitioning for the reduction of a death sentence to life in prison. And if she had been executed, it would have been extremely surprising, to be quite honest, because very few women had been guillotined, looking back in the last 15 years, for this same sort of charge.
Right, okay.
So the fact that she was even given that as a court sentence, I think shows just the hatred that people felt for her in that room.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was such an unusual sentence to get in the first place. Her lawyer and mother start petitioning. Her mother even writes to the president and the wife of the president. And her mother, it's quite interesting, throughout the trial, so this is only brought forward in the trial, not in the reports that she, or interviews she gave to the media before this, starts blaming Violetta's, you know, then boyfriend, Jean Dabon, and says there's absolutely no way that Violetta could have carried out the murders herself. She should be excused because it was actually this man right. that did it.
Yeah.
This also pissed me off because it's like they were, a couple of people believed her and the press, some of the press started believed her that Jean Dabon was involved. The police obviously arrested him, you know, during the investigation, realized he was out of town. He had nothing to do with this. I didn't like Violetta very much to begin with. It was kind of sad, actually, like reading his statements to the police and how little he thought about this woman.
Mm.
And her mother just can't believe she would have done this. But then her mother seems to be a world-class delusionist, I guess.
Yeah.
The president doesn't pardon her, but does commute her sentence. And she's put in prison. She ends up spending 12 years in prison for this crime, all through World War II as well. She's in two different prisons. One she's moved to because the first prison is on the German border and it becomes captured.
Oh, right.
And they needed to make sure that all of the prisoners were, you know, not captured by the Germans and instead served out their sentences.
Yeah, I wonder what would have happened to them.
I know. So they put her in another prison that's run by nuns, and she converts to Catholicism. And while serving, it's funny, she's described as being an absolute model prisoner. She became incredibly pious. She was seen as being very virtuous, very repentant, and quite industrious, and kind of like all the things that you would look for in kind of traditional woman. And I can actually imagine, like, putting myself in her situation, I can imagine being in prison for her is quite freeing. She's away from men. She's given a lot of structure around her days. Religion is kind of brought into her life really seriously for the first time, and it gives her something to believe in, a doctrine that is about forgiveness, about repentance.
And she feels safe.
And she feels, she feels complete. She is completely safe for the first time since she was, you know, a small child.
Yeah.
And she does incredibly well there. She's released 12 years later. At this point, she's already met her future husband. She was evidently divorced. She was slightly older, and he was the son of a bursar for whom she helped do work for during her prison sentence. And they were very discreetly wed after she gets released. And their first child is born 7 months after the wedding. She then changes her name. They open a restaurant, which is quite successful. Unfortunately, he dies. I don't remember exactly how long, but quite early, he passes away.
Don't they have five kids together?
But they have five children together.
Yeah.
And so her mother ends up moving back in with her.
Wow.
And so she and her children, under different names, run this restaurant until she dies. In 1963, she is finally given full rehabilitation, which means her sentence is completely scratched from the record.
Yeah.
And this is the first time anyone sentenced to death in France is given back their full legal rights, which I think shows just how much this has changed. She dies 3 years later. She was outlived by her mother, her five children, and she died in her mother's arms. So let's talk about the Surrealists.
Yeah, who came out in support of her, very strongly in support of her. And obviously, for them, she symbolized something quite profound. And I guess they were a generation of artists who wanted to disregard the previous generation and ridicule it in many ways. And I think they really sympathized with her case and with the amount of the demonization that was happening towards her from mainstream society. So they made this booklet, which was published in Belgium, I believe, because it would have actually been illegal to publish it in France because of the content. And there were various images and poems inspired by her situation. Wasn't one of the poems called The Little Daddy Who Raped?
Yes, that was by Paul Elard.
And you showed me a picture from the booklet as well, slightly horrifying kind of illustration, reminiscent of perhaps some of the children's books of the time or the popular artwork of a little girl sitting on her father's lap, and her father has his hand up her skirt, and another man, a sort of official-looking type in a bowler hat, is looking on.
And not doing a damn thing about it.
Yeah.
And I think the man looking on kind of represents the judicial court, the lawyers, the judge, and, you know, the rest of this kind of patriarchal society condoning the incest.
Yeah, and I feel that some of the vitriol that was directed towards her was this feeling that she hadn't just killed her parents, but she symbolised the younger generation attempting to murder the older generation. And because of that, the Surrealists naturally would sympathise with her because they were of the younger generation.
Yeah, they said that they believed her unequivocally, but even if she had been lying, they insisted Violetta had been sexually exploited by a range of men, and with Germaine, her mother's angry defection, was left alone to face a phalanx of male authorities, judges, lawyers, doctors, policemen, and journalists, whose gut sympathy clearly lay with the dead father.
Yeah, and I find it really interesting that they came out with this, because I hadn't sort of appreciated that the Surrealists had this feminist streak. And it also calls to mind people like Anais Nin, who I believe had there was some issue with incest there and her father as well, and but obviously was a key figure of this kind of intellectual movement.
I think, so the Surrealist who'd brought this to attention to kind of his fellow artists, because there were 15 prominent Surrealists that got together to create this book,
which
I think is incredible. And this was the work, really, of André Breton, who's the one that I think was so inspired by what Violetta was going through.
And he's probably one of the main figures of the whole movement, really.
I think what is really interesting to note about this case is that this case is happening in the press at the same point that the Nuremberg rallies are going on. And evidently, according to a close source of his, it's mentioned several times that he was incensed that Violetta Nozier was getting all of this press. And there was a cartoon that a famous French cartoonist put forward at the time of Hitler, like, throwing a tantrum, going, "Violetta, Violetta, it's always Violetta." Because in France, that was what was being covered, not the Nuremberg rallies.
Yeah.
And I would really love to, I haven't found this yet, and I'm not sure if it exists, but, you know, any aspiring historians out there, I would love to kind of look at an exposé of the case in kind of light of the rise of Nazism. Because I think there are a lot of interesting parallels between there that could be had.
Expand on that.
I don't feel like I know enough about this, because this is never a period of history that I've really studied, but I feel like personally, just in the very little I've read about the rise of Hitler, is that his entire thing is kind of the restoration of family values and return to normality that was so craved by the German people. But it's not just happening in Germany. It's happening in Italy, it's happening in France even. And Violetta bringing these accusations against her, you know, working class done good parents, it goes against everything this generation craved.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it showed the cracks in society. And I think, again, as you said, this is what really inspired that hatred of her and how and why she was so demonized.
But ultimately, it was kind of a... It's an ultimately futile movement, isn't it? You know, it's a kind of... It's like the last swan song of a type of conservatism that was dying off.
I kind of wish I could say that. I don't know. Parts of me, I mean, my own background growing up in the southern part of America, in a place that's incredibly conservative, incredibly religious, and where incest is widely prevalent. I feel like maybe, you know, this case is still really relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why I want people to know about Violetta. I want them to know about her story. I want them, you know, not to emulate her. I'm not, to be very clear, we are not advocating that anybody go out and murder anybody. But I do want them to understand her plight, understand the struggle that she was going through, and be sympathetic to it. Can I ask you a silly question? Do you think Violetta is more of a demon or more of a dame?
I think that's kind of irrelevant, if that's not rude.
No, excellent. Why is it irrelevant?
I suppose there's this kind of tendency now to, like, look at quote-unquote badass women and to kind of celebrate that. But we can't really celebrate what she did, even if we sympathise with it. She was a victim of circumstance. And obviously her case has been glamorised, but at the end of the day, there's nothing particularly glamorous about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. Sophie, thank you so much for joining me in this exploration of Violetta's life. And this has not been, like, the most fun person we've looked at, but I think the case is so important, both for the response that it had at the time, and I think the kind of the continuing importance that this case has had. Thank you all very much for listening. If you are interested, I am going to share a bunch of photos of the case and some of the pictures from the pamphlet that the Surrealist put together on our Instagram and Twitter. So please check it out, and thank you so much for joining us.
Guilt will always find you out, hang above your bed in a nebulous shroud, so you might as well have something to be guilty about. We sit in coffee shops and discuss the subject of lust.